עבדו את השם בשמחה, עבדו את השם בשמחה, בואו לפנה בירננה, לפנה בירננה. עבדו את השם בשמחה, עבדו את השם בשמחה, בואו לפנה בירננה, לפנה בירננה.
Shalom everybody and welcome to the Yishai Fleischer Show, broadcasting live from Judea to the world. You're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom and welcome to Malka Fleischer.
Hello there.
Wow, there's a lot. There's good, yeah. There's bad, there's ugly, there's beautiful. Let's start with a little bit of beauty. First thing, it was this past Shabbat was my birthday. That's right.
I turned
a certain age, and that age is good because it's great to be alive.
Yeah, better than the alternative.
It's just great to be alive, and it's great to be alive in our great time. And I want to thank you, Malka, that you threw a nice Suda Shlishi party for me at the house.
You're welcome,
Mazel Tov. And all the people that are my friends in the town came in. And also a little kiddush at the Chabad Shul downstairs here. And so that was really fun. It's just good to celebrate and be alive. And I want to wish everybody, you're supposed to, send blessings to people. So I want to bless everybody with strength. And I want to bless everybody specifically with strength to get through this period, which is going to be a tough period and going to be a tough period because... we'll get to it in a second, but the bad guys are sticking their heads out of their little holes and are coming out to do bad things. And there's a bad side to that, which means Jews get hurt, soldiers get hurt. There's a good side in that when the bad guys come out to fight, we identify them and start to chase them down and get rid of them and also show the rest that we mean business and we are here to stay. We'll get to that in a second. Another thing about today's date, Malka, is that today is Gimel Tammuz, which is both the day that Joshua stopped the sun when he was fighting here in the land of Israel, and it is also the day of passing of the Lubavitch Rebbe, who is a big influence in our lives, 29 years ago, Gimel Tammuz. And we had a little party yesterday, which coincided with Gimel Tammuz. We actually have a good friend named Shlomo, who was our lone soldier, our adopted lone soldier for many years, and basically our kind of adopted guy here in Israel. That's the chesed that Malka and myself do, one of our little kindnesses. God bless you, Malka.
Thank you.
And he got engaged to wonderful Miriam, and Malka, you had the schut of making your first Shidduch.
Yes. Shlish Gan Eden, as it were.
What does that mean?
One third. There is a belief that if you can make three marriage couplings, if you can make three marriages, basically, then you get to go to the Garden of Eden. Bang. Right in there. Key. Open the golden gates.
Well, it makes sense.
Walk right in.
It makes sense because if
no harm, no foul.
Because if you were able to make three unions in this world, then first thing, we know that the union itself symbolizes a certain Garden of Eden, right? That's the Garden of Eden is Adam and Chava. And if you were able to be the kind of person who brings this world forward in such a way, and you have to be a loving person to be able to make other people find love. You can't do it. If you're not that kind of person who thinks in a loving way, then there's no way you could have the talent to... It's not a math.
Well, maybe it's... For some people, it might be a math, no. Especially for matchmakers and things like that. I'm not officially a matchmaker.
I'm saying it's not a math. It's a skill that comes in... It's in relationship with being the kind of person who has a good marriage, which means it's a loving person. That's just the way it is. Like, you can't think about these things if you're not in that kind of mindset. So first thing, I want to wish you congratulations.
Thanks.
That you may have earned Shlish Gan Eden.
I'm happy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And of course, more importantly, is that you were able with, and of course, you've admitted it, you've said it many times at the various parties associated with this marriage. You've said Hashem is channeled through you. You really felt that Hashem was like sent it into your mind.
It's not because I'm a genius.
Although you are, sweetie.
That is an additional nice thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not related. But you know how it is. You think of two people. Probably some of you out there listening know what I'm talking about.
Right.
You're like walking around. Everything's fine. And then all of a sudden you're like, hang on a sec.
Right.
I need to put this person together with this person.
Right.
You know, I have made job shiduchim before.
Me too.
And that one is like, you're like, this person needs a work and this person has a job.
Right.
That could go.
That could go. That could work. Right.
And then that's really nice when you can make a job shidduch. But right. to make a like a love shidduch, right. that's pretty cool.
So congratulations for that. And we wish Shlomo and Miriam lots of love and lots of strength and lots of Garden of Eden and spreading it out to others and to continue with your shlichut. And yesterday, amongst the two little talks that I gave yesterday at the Sheva Brachot that we threw, the little, it's a post-wedding party that we threw here at our house, that you threw at the house, I helped out. One of the things that I said was continue with your shlichut, with your emissary work, with your godly, what God has sent you to do in this right. world. And I said, if there was one word that would encapsulate the real message of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, it would be shlichut.
Right.
It would be to be...
Get out there and do your job.
Yeah, and touch another person's life, touch another Jewish person's right,
help
life.
Help a Jew.
Or
a good person.
That's right, or the nations. By the way, the Rebbe also talked about the nations a lot. Get out there and be active, like fulfill your duty in this world. You've been sent. You're not just you. This may seem like a small thing. I have learned through the wisdom of my birthday, of the additional years.
Yes.
Is that it's small trajectories change everything. Small changes in trajectory. If you just think of yourself as being born onto yourself and having to live your life fully, as opposed to that somebody that you were birthed as being sent by somebody else, mm-hmm. that Hashem like put you into this world for a job, that you're really not born but really employed, that you're really a shaliach is the best. Monica, can you find me another translation for the word shaliach, like an emissary, a messenger,
those are the ones.
An agent. Like if you know that you're an agent of something else, Hashem, or a great Torah leader like the Lubavitcher Rebbe, you know that you've been sent. And if you speak to Lubavitch Chabad folks, they'll send to you. They'll say I'm the Rebbe's shliach in Manitoba. I don't know what and they feel that they have been sent to do a work in that area. And that's what we should all feel. We should all feel that we have been sent to do work on our lives. If we just think that we've kind of sent ourselves, that we're like here because we're here, and so now we got to maximize it, you live a very shallow life relatively to that. But when you live a life of a shlichut, you really live a much fuller life. A group of people that are definitely shlichim in our life is the soldiers of the IDF, and they are very much working hard these days. It's really clear that terrorism, it's raising its ugly head yet again. You and I lived through the knifing terror spree. And now it looks like the guns that we've known that have been amassed in Judea and Samaria, in the so-called Palestinian Authority controlled areas, and in mixed Israeli-Arab cities or in Arab cities in Israel proper, small Israel, whatever you want to call it, the pre-1967 Israel. Those weapons are now starting to turn on us, as of course they were going to. There was never a question. It's obvious that it was obvious to us that those weapons were going to turn. And so much so, Malka, that you were telling me about the bravery of an elite unit that was fighting against terrorism in Jenin that got pinned down by gunfire.
Right.
Until they sent in like an Apache Cobra.
Helicopter.
I think Apache, right?
Yes.
And it like...
And it shot like a missile at the people who were targeting the Israeli soldiers and eliminated them, and they were able to rescue the soldiers out of there.
Right. So basically a chopper came in.
Right. Which hasn't happened, I understand, since like in 20 years, something like that. We haven't used a helicopter inside Israel.
Well, the thing is that helicopters has... first thing, helicopters can even be vulnerable to just small arms fire. Like you could shoot an M16 helicopter and it could go down from that. But so that's one challenge. But the bigger challenge is just shooting rockets inside a cityscape. It could have a lot of collateral damage. And Israel tries not to do that. But the point is that we're, you know, the guns are coming out. So they're shooting at our soldiers. They got pinned down. And of course, our soldiers, one of the reasons they get pinned down is instead of like leveling a place, we're so cautious about collateral damage, about civilian damage, and maybe too cautious, you know, maybe too cautious. And so here, but our forces were in deep trouble, and they just, you know, they shot a rocket right at the terrorists and got and killed them. And that was good. And that's good. And there's a heated situation coming up right now. And the heat is on many levels. For example, Prime Minister Netanyahu is allowing Jews to move into Evyatar and not kicking them out.
Right.
After this, we had a big terrorist act.
Right.
In which four Jews were murdered in a place that I was just at a few weeks ago. There is the beautiful town of Eilim,
including three young men who I think none of them had any kids.
Right. We're talking about Eilim. Now, Eilim is a beautiful community in Samaria.
Near Shiloh.
And you drive on Route 60. You look up at the top and you see, because there are mountains on both sides. And on the right side, you see this beautiful community at the top of this mountain. And it's just, everybody says it's very idyllic and very very warm and wonderful community. And there's a cemetery at the bottom. There was always a gas station there. But recently they added a great restaurant.
A hummus restaurant.
A hummus restaurant called Hummus Eliyahu.
Which is a chain restaurant.
Right. Elijah's Hummus. Do you understand what we're talking about here? We're talking about Elijah and hummus together. And that happened to be that I was driving up to an event with Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir at Evyatar.
Mm-hmm.
And I was quite hungry. Really, I felt quite hungry. I hadn't eaten that day, and I was about to go to a thing, and I just didn't know when the next calorie was coming to me. I pulled in there, and it's this like little box. It's like a little restaurant that's like made out of like simple materials, just like a box there. But the food was fabulous, and the guys were cool. And you know what? I totally understand why the terrorists struck at that. Mm. I totally understand. Because that little restaurant on the road there.
Just a little peaceful, happy place for people.
Yes, but that's not where I was going. It says something. It says, we're going to open up a huge restaurant here and a huge shopping plaza. And this place is normative. This is where we're going to be. We're going to be here. We're going to be eating here. We're going to be living here. We Judeans and Samaritans and Jewish people of the mountains, the mountain Jews, right? Like, we're going to be here. And like that restaurant, like I sat there and I was like, you know, Zeha Katan Gadoli, this little one shall be big. And just this amazing feeling there. And I was just like, I can understand why the terrorists want to strike at that, because they want to strike at us, our normalization, our effort to be here. And that's exactly what they did. Interesting, by the way, next day, the restaurant was open after this terror attack. I saw it in the news. Went in.
Wow. Cleaned it up.
It still had bullet holes in it.
Oh, my gosh.
But they were serving hummus. They were serving hummus there, just like that. Really, they were serving hummus. Sometimes we Israelis take it a bit to an extreme where we're like, we're right back to business. But then other times it's like an amazing thing. It's like, we're not shutting down. We're going to clean up the blood. We're gonna clean up the bullet holes, the glass. And you know what? We're going to be serving hummus because that's what we're here to do. And it's just like, whoa. You know, that was an intensity. And you know, Maka, I got on I-24 News called me, and I was on twice in the span of a few hours. And they put me up against people. They put me up to debate people. We could put some of that debate here, some of the audio from that debate here. But I want to, in fact, okay, let's put up just a little bit. Let's have Ben put up a little bit of my talk on I-24 right here.
Jihadism is being taught in the schools, in the mosques, in the homes. And we know that. We know that these people are portrayed as martyrs, not for human rights, but for Allah, for jihadism, and for the great act of trying to destroy Israel. If you go to the market in Hebron, even in Jerusalem, you will see the map of Israel sold as a keychain, sold as a t-shirt, and yet what's written over all of Israel is Palestine. This is an effort to erase Israel. Israel.
In your map, there are Palestinians. In your map, in your house, when you have a map, Samaria, do you see Palestine in your map?
The erasure will continue throughout the whole country. Even if you don't mind, I didn't interrupt you, so give me a second here just to explain my position. And that is that we have to fight against those forces. There are many Arabs that hate jihadism. There are many Palestinians that despise the Hamas and the PLO and want a decent life with Israel. But they're usually beaten down. And that's what they tell me every time. They say to me, because you guys don't strike against the jihad, we are sublimated below them. We cannot live a normal life. We cannot say what we want because we live in fear from the same people you live in fear in. And so the only solution is to strike hard against jihadism, not at the end of it when it comes out and does terror, but at the root of it, where it teaches neo-Nazi ideology. There is no-go zones in Judea and Samaria. There are no-go zones in Jerusalem, no-go zones not far from Tel Aviv, and we have to
this
root those
totally
things out.
Lies. Root out this is idea. Lies, and this is the way to fool the public, because the reality is that the Palestinians are fighting against the occupation. It's not about the jihad.
When you
see the people that made this horrible terrorist attack, and when you see who are them, they are not religious. Many of them are secular, and they are doing it on behalf of the Palestinian Liberty Movement.
You are just a front for the jihad yourself. That's the way it is. And you want to paint it as human rights, but it's not human rights.
I'm talking about the reality.
Okay, so what you heard is just a little bit from it. But there was also a guy that was like cutting me off all the time, people on the Israeli left, and I got an email about that.
Wow.
Hello, Yishai. This is Isaac. I don't know if you remember me. We met off and on several times. The last time was in the shul in Hebron. Afterwards, you gave myself and my wife, my visiting sister and me, a tour of Kevarut.
Nice.
I wanted to comment on the debate you had on I-24 with the Israeli general and the Meretz guy a couple of days ago. What this interview demonstrated, in no small part thanks to you, was the vehement opposition to the Zionist ideals by Meretz and the elitist attitude of the general and his leftist dribble. The Meretz guy tried to characterize you as a religious fanatic, and the general arrogantly tried to classify you as an ignoramus. Yishai, for me, this interview was a nightmarishly stark contrast of the deep division between the radical left and Torah-believing Jews and their inalienable rights to the land of Israel. The divisions between fellow Jews, who believe that our land can be negotiated away to terrorists, who publicly claim their wish to destroy us, is beyond frightening. Thanks to you, you demonstrated their shameful beliefs that are void of any trace of Judaism. When our own people rise against our inheritance to our land, we need to unite and pray even more fervently than ever. Isaac.
Very nice. Thank you, Isaac. You know, I put up a tweet also after the terror attack. I felt I should say something. Of course, we're all in pain. You know, the first moments after a terror attack, at least for me, I don't know how other people deal with it, and you should never have another experience of it in order to see how you feel. But I get like a little numb at the beginning, and I like don't even know what to do. I think I just like go inward a little. But then after a while, you're like, wait a second, like we need to say something, you know, like we need to stand up for each other, and we need to stand up for these people who were taken from us and for their families and for what they stood for. And so I put out a tweet, because after the terror attack, I got a lot of like messages, like, and saw a lot of messages online, like evict the terrorists, you know, power to the resistance, free Palestine, right? After four people were literally gassing up their cars or like eating a sandwich and they were shot and killed, right? That's what they were doing. So I put out a tweet, and I was like, I'm not going to read you the tweet. You can go to my Twitter account.
No, I actually.
Oh, you want to read it out loud?
I think it's quite worth it to read the tweet, and there's a reason why it did well. It's because it was an important tweet. I have it for you here, Mount Michael.
Okay.
Here you go.
Okay, so I'll read the tweet. Fine. Here's my tweet. It goes like this: Some young Jews at a gas station were massacred by the jihad today. To drive their ambitions home, some special types have contacted me with messages like power to the resistance, free Palestine, and evict the settlers. First, I appreciate your honesty. Thanks for not hiding behind false apologetics and fake lip service to human rights. You want us dead, and I respect the reality of that. Second, fair enough. There's a real war going on. Sometimes it runs hot, sometimes less. but healthiest and most productive that we all just acknowledge it out loud. That being said, do you really think killing four of us will create a Palestine or destroy an Israel? 40? 400? I know it's always fun to throw a party in Shechem or Gaza, but do you not realize how utterly futile these attacks are? In the end, you will fail. There will never be a Palestine on the land of Israel. We will not budge one inch. You caused us pain today, that's definitely true. But we'll just kill the killers. You achieved nothing, like every other day. Choose life. Abandon the fruitless fight for control in the land of Israel. So I put up that
tweet. Very good,
Malka.
Very good tweet. Very powerful. A lot of powerful messages there.
Thank you. You're not the only one who felt that it resonated for them, and I'm very happy about that. You know, it got 1,200 likes on Twitter, which is quite a lot for me, and I think a lot in general.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's nice to get likes, but the point is not the likes. The point is that there were other people out there who needed to be able to express this message, and it came into my head, and I put it out there, and I hope that I was able to help other people express that sentiment, which is like, obviously we need to like rage against this terror enterprise, and we need to hold on to the land of Israel. But as it is, it seems that we're like in this protracted back and forth and back and forth. And sometimes I think to myself, they don't understand. You know, they go out with such a zest for shooting a Jew in the head, right? And then we shoot him in the head. And then what? Like, yes, you made one of our families cry and devastated them. That is correct. But did you, and then what? Like, did you get something? Did your family achieve something? Did your tribe achieve something? Did your town get a benefit? Did you like advance something forward? You advanced nothing forward for yourself. Nothing at all. You got nothing. You did nothing, and you died as a nothing. And it's all such a waste.
I have to say something about that, Malka.
Yeah.
A piece of Torah that I heard years ago answers your question.
Okay.
And it's from Rabbi Charlap, the May Marom. And Rabbi Charlap writes that it says in the Torah, don't serve other gods. Lo tavod Elohim acherim.
Yeah.
He says, but there are no other gods.
Right.
So who are you serving?
Who are you exactly serving?
So
yeah.
He says something kind of like a little off the norm. He says, there are other gods, but they're really Elohim me'achrim. They're gods that slow you down. There are forces in this world that want to slow down the Geula process. It's coming. It'll happen. But there are forces out there that want to retard and slow down the redemption process. And he goes, don't serve those. We'll serve the other ones. Serve the pro-redemption process.
Right.
But basically, there are elements like those folks. You're right. They know that they're not really productive. And they know that they're actually regressive. And they know that they're not serving anything for their folks.
Yeah, but they die. That's the thing that I can't, that is hard for me to wrap my head around.
Because they're not about life. They're not pro-life. They are not pro-life or pro-choice.
Yeah, but for their own self?
They are not pro-life. They are not elements. They are elements of chaos. They're elements of, they are thanatos.
I saw a picture of the guy the guy they killed.
Yeah.
At the gas station. The guy that, there was some incredible heroic guy who got into like a fist fight with him and just emptied his gun on this guy until he stopped moving, basically, which is unfortunately what you have to do. They showed a picture anyway. They showed a picture in the news of the kid that shot the people, the one that didn't get away, and with standing in his cap and gown, holding his diploma. And you're like, what? Like, what was this for? Like, why did you get a diploma? Why did you graduate? Like, what? You look like you're headed toward a future, but you're futureless. You're dust. It's hard to understand.
And when it comes to that, I do understand. When you're part of the jihad train, when you're part of something great,
Yeah, but Yishai, the tippy top people of this something great of the quote unquote jihad train, they don't go do this stuff.
Everybody knows
they
that.
They make big money. They invest in cement companies.
Right.
They like take summer trips to Qatar. They have fancy cars. They like that is not what the real operators of the jihad do at all. They don't send their kids. They don't send their kids to go attack Jews. They don't make their kids even commanders.
That's also true. Okay. The psychology of bad guys is one that can be endlessly analyzed. But bottom line, Malka, is that we're home and we got to act like we're home. And we get the bad guys, but we actually do not go in to the terror ideology nests. And we don't eradicate them. We don't go in strong. That's just a fact. And we don't use these attacks as an opportunity to go in really, really strong.
Well, we did have an interesting operation again last night. For the second time, mm-hmm. Israel used explosive drones.
Yep.
To kill.
No, it wasn't explosive drones. It was like a rocket launching drone, I think. I think it was a drone.
Let's see.
But the bottom line is a drone, like a killing drone, went out there and got like five
maybe
terrorists.
Yeah, it's unclear to me. Here's one thing that's a little bit interesting. I was reading a story about this drone attack, and which I think is will start to send a little bit of dread into the hearts of terrorism, because this little machine can like come from anywhere. And there's no like IDF soldier to shoot at. So I think it's a very interesting policy. It turns out that this green light to use armed drones was given in September 2022. That was actually under the Bennett government. Or was it the Lapid government? I think it's actually under the Lapid government, which is not something you would think. Right. You would not necessarily think that the Bennett Lapid government would have done that. But that was under Chief of Staff Aviv Kochavi when he was a general. Chief of Staff. Anyway, I just thought that was pretty interesting.
All right. Malka, speaking of drone killing, I have absolutely no way to connect that to anything else. I do want to mention some of the folks that make this show happen. And last week, I actually forgot to mention our good friends at RetroWatch, and they are moving to the land of Israel, and they're continuing their RetroWatch guy-ness, RetroWatchGuy.com. Great watches from the 60s and 70s. And they some of the stuff they've been sending lately is really high-end and cool. So if you're looking for like a high-end watch but like a little retro, it's awesome. So that's RetroWatchGuy.com, and they support them not only by buying a watch, but by the fact that they're bringing their business to the land of Israel. That's really exciting. And the good folks at the Israel Bible, at the end, it's all about the Bible. And if you don't have a Bible in your house, or you want a really pretty one with good English Hebrew that you could follow the Hebrew or the English with great translation, transliteration, and commentary specifically about the land of Israel, theisraelbible.com is your place. And, of course, you can put on coupon code Yishai and bang, get yourself 10% off. So that's really neat. And get yourself an Israel Bible. I have one. I think I have two. I think I gave one to Vice President Pence.
That's right.
That's right. That was cool. All right. So we have a lot of folks that really make our show happen. And we also have friends we have a lot of friends out there, including great Jewish folks and also the International Torah Congregation, the Abrahamic faith folks that are out there. We all want the blessing of a priest. And we have our own priest here, Rabbi Shimshon HaKohen Nadel, who is rabbi at Jerusalem's Kehilat Zichron Yosef. And he's got the tale today of a Jew who rebelled against Moses, the biblical story of Korach. Who was Korach? What was his effect? And what is the lessons from that time? Here's Rabbi Shimshon Nadel.
Shalom Yishai. This Shabbat, the Torah portion of Korach is read in synagogues throughout the diaspora. But who was Korach? And what was the nature of his sin? What did he do that was so wrong, so egregious? He and his followers meet such an end, being swallowed up by the earth and consumed by fire. An end so strange, so bizarre, so unnatural, that according to our sages, it had to be built into creation itself. As the Mishnah in Avot teaches, 10 things were created on the eve of that first Shabbat during the 6 days of creation at twilight. And one of them is the mouth in the earth, which swallowed up Korach and his followers. What was so dangerous about the nature of this rebellion? At first glance, Korach's rebellion appears to be purely political. It's about power. He challenges the authority of Moshe and Aaron. He argues that they have taken too much power for themselves. But according to the Midrash, Korach's argument is theological, spiritual, religious. Our sages relate that Korach asked Moshe, "What is the law regarding the tchelet, the strand of blue in the tzitzit, the fringes, which we are commanded at the end of the previous parasha? What if one has a garment which is completely blue? Why does he need one little strand? How does one little strand exempt the garment? It's illogical. And what if one has a home filled with Jewish books and scrolls and texts? Why does one little mezuzah, one little scroll at the entrance to one's home on the doorpost exempt the home? What about all the books and scrolls and texts in the home?" In this dialogue, which our sages present, Moshe listens and answers Korach, "But that's not what we were commanded. That's not how we were commanded. Instead, you have manufactured this, created this from your heart." Korach invents a new religion. The Midrash then continues and tells us that Korach immediately separates himself with his followers and begins the rebellion. Korach's sin was so egregious, his rebellion so dangerous. He and his followers meet such a terrible end because his rebellion was not merely against Moshe. It was against the authority of the Torah itself. Korach's arguments, both in the Torah text as well as the Midrash, make a lot of sense. They're logical. One may even suggest that Korach was wise and learned, a sage. But like the Zaken Mamre, the rebellious elder, who is indeed one of the sages, but ultimately is put to death for not accepting the authority of the other rabbis and sages, the authority of the Torah, Korach is misguided. In the Kitvei Ha'ari, the writings and teachings of the great Kabbalist Rabbi Yitzchak Luria Ashkenazi, you find a connection between the biblical characters of Korach, Cain, and Nadav and Avihu. In a number of places, it is recorded that both Korach and Nadav and Avihu were reincarnations of an aspect of the soul of Cain. They are all somehow connected, related. In fact, if you examine closely the biblical verses themselves, there is a parallelism. Very similar language is used in all three stories, perhaps to intentionally evoke this connection for the reader. In Genesis chapter 4, it states that Hashem did not turn towards Cain's offering. And in Numbers 16, Moshe asks Hashem not to turn towards the offering of Korach's followers. In Genesis 4, Cain is cursed from the ground, which opened wide its mouth to absorb his brother's blood. And in Numbers 16, the earth opened wide its mouth to swallow up the rebels, their households, and all of their possessions. In Leviticus chapter 10, Nadav and Avihu, the two sons of Aaron, took fire pans and placed upon them fire and incense. And in Numbers 16, the rebels took fire pans and placed upon them fire and incense. In Leviticus 10, a fire issues forth from before Hashem and consumes Nadav and Avihu. And in Numbers 16, a fire issues forth from before Hashem and consumes the 250 rebels of Korach. In fact, according to the Midrash, the rebels are commanded by Moshe to take fire pans and place upon them incense, as on the one hand, the incense is a most beloved service in the eyes of Hashem, but on the other hand, it can be an elixir of death in the language of the Midrash, as in the case of Nadav and Avihu. In Leviticus 10, following the death of Nadav and Avihu, Hashem says, "I am sanctified through those who are close to me." And in Numbers 16, following the death of the rebels, their fire pans are collected and made into a cover, a paneling for the altar, because those fire pans have become sanctified. In the original Hebrew, the language in all of these verses is basically the same. It's uncanny. So what do all three stories have in common? What is the link between Korach, Cain, and Nadav and Avihu? The answer is simple. They all wanted to serve Hashem as they saw fit, instead of serving him the way he asked to be served, instead of following the proper procedures and protocols, the rules. They may all have had good intentions, but the lesson in all of these cases, narratives, stories, it's not only about intentions. Cain brought an offering to Hashem even before his brother Hevel. But whereas Hevel brings the choicest of his flock, as the Torah records, Cain's offering doesn't even merit description in the text. According to our sages, he brought some junk, some leftover flax, whatever he had left over in the field. He argued it's the thought that counts. What does it matter what I bring? It's about intentions. Nadav and Avihu, the two sons of Aaron, they too may have had good intentions. After all, they were the future leaders of the Jewish people. They had a fire burning within them to serve Hashem, but they brought a strange fire that Hashem did not command, as the Torah records, and they were consumed by a fire. Korach too may have had good intentions. In fact, the very fire pans that the rebels use become sanctified, holy, and become covers, panels for the holy altar, perhaps suggesting something redeeming about him and his rebellion. But as the Torah instructs, those fire pans on the altar are there to serve as a reminder for the children of Israel not to make the same mistake. It's not always about intentions. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik called Korach's rebellion a common sense rebellion against Torah authority, because it's rooted in logic, in common sense. But there is a danger, a great danger, in serving Hashem, as Rabbi Soloveitchik warns, solely based on logic and human emotions. And that is the lesson of Korach. The Talmud, in Tractate Sanhedrin, records how the great sage, Rabbi Bar Bar Chana, related the following story. One time he was walking on the path, he was traveling, and he met an Arab merchant who told him, "Come, and I will show you the place where Korach and his followers were swallowed up." Rabbi Bar Bar Chana follows this Arab merchant, and he is shown two fissures in the ground from which smoke is emerging. The Arab merchant then takes a piece of wool, soaks it in water, and places it on the tip of his spear, and passes the dampened wool over the smoke. Immediately, the wool is singed. The Arab merchant then asks Rabbi Bar Chana, "Listen, what do you hear?" And Rabbi Bar Chana relates that he heard them saying over and over again, "Moshe and his Torah are true, and we are liars." The passage continues that every 30 days, Korach and his followers are returned to this very place, like meat cooking in a cauldron, and they repeat over and over again, "Moshe and his Torah are true, and we are liars." Wishing all of the listeners a Shabbat Shalom and blessings from Jerusalem.
Okay, Rabbi Shimshon, thank you so much for joining us here on the Yishai Fleischer Show. And thank you folks for joining me on the Yishai Fleischer Show. We have a lot of folks, Michael, that make the show really happen, including our good friends at the Hebron Fund. And the summer is ready to receive you as a tourist at Hebron, at the Jewish community of Hebron, Chevron, and at the Tomb of the Mamas and the Papas, the Tomb of the Patriarchs, the Matriarchs. Come and visit us, please, and go to HebronFund.org. Book your tour. When you're coming to the Land of Israel, give it like a little bit more than a half a day, really, to be toured. Be toured by the great Simcha Hachban. You will. Your life is going to change because of that. So go to HebronFund.org and definitely join us for a tour there. And also, I want to thank so much the folks at another kind of tour is to see the Land of Israel from a bicycle, okay? And the way you could do that is you could go to koshercycletours.com, kosher. It's both kosher and it's a cycle and it's a tour, okay? So that's why it's called koshercycletour.com. You get to see the Land of Israel or other places around the world, actually, but in kosher style. And with a minion, with kosher food, and with great professionalism, great bicycles, and just for all levels. And we've had great experiences reported from the folks who joined Kosher Cycle Tours. Okay, Malka, we also have another Kohen in our life, and that's Ben Bresky. And this time, he's got also an amazing historical story about Yonatan Ben Uziel, who is buried in a place called Amuka, in north of Israel, and we have a special report.
We were talking about Shidduchim before.
Right, and what's the connection?
We'll have to see.
That's right. There's a connection between Yonatan Ben Uziel and finding your prospective mates, your soulmate. So here's Ben Bresky with Amuka.
This is a moment in Jewish history. I almost made it to Amuka. I even arranged with Yishai Fleischer to make time on Thursday when his show is released so I could make the trek up to the small northern village to visit the grave of the great Rabbi Yonatan ben Uziel. But I never made it. Yonatan ben Uziel was one of the Tanaim who lived in the Land of Israel during the Second Temple era. He was considered the greatest of the students of Hillel. He wrote the Targum Yonatan, a translation into Aramaic of the Hebrew books of the prophets, done so in order to let the common person study the text. The Talmud records that when it was stated that Yonatan ben Uziel translated the biblical words, the land of Israel shuddered, and a heavenly voice was heard, saying, "Who is it that dared reveal my secrets to human beings?" Yonatan ben Uziel stood up and said, "I am the one who revealed your secrets, but it was not for my own honor, nor for the honor of my father's house, but rather I did it for your honor, in order to minimize the arguments between the Jewish people." Yonatan ben Uziel also asked permission to reveal the other writings of the Bible, but the heavenly voice said, "You have revealed enough for the moment, because if you reveal all the secrets now, then the date of the dawning of the age of final redemption will be revealed." The Kabbalistic book Sefer Migdanim is also attributed to Yonatan ben Uziel. It was said of him that when he was learning Torah, any bird that flew over him would be burned by the fire in his aura of energy above him. All the heavenly angels would gather around him to hear his Torah thoughts. This was in the days of Hillel and Shammai, who were both great and respected teachers, but also rivals. Although Yonatan was a student of Hillel, Shammai respected him as well. One story is told of a wealthy person who willed all his possessions to Yonatan rather than his own children because they had left tradition. Yonatan kept one-third of the inheritance, donated one-third to the Holy Temple, and returned one-third to the disinherited children. Shammai questioned his decision to give any money to the children against their father's wishes, but Yonatan argued since he was the legal owner of the inheritance, it was his right to do as he saw fit, and Shammai agreed. According to tradition, Yonatan ben Uziel never married. He was too busy dedicating his life to study. Another version states that he eventually did get married, but regretted not doing so earlier because he never had any children. Thus, over the centuries, people have prayed at the grave of Rabbi Yonatan for a good match and for fertility. One story explains that he told his disciples before his passing that since he had not any children of his own, those who prayed at his grave would be granted their match within 1 year and merit to have children. This is particularly popular on the anniversary of his passing in the summer month of Sivan, which took place last Thursday. The village of Amuka, where the grave is located, gets its name from the Hebrew word for deep. In the period of the Mishnah, there existed a Jewish village called Kfar Amiko, which means deepened village. The Crusaders mentioned it by name and stated it was a Jewish village near Sfat. Rabbi Shmuel ben Shimshon wrote about the tomb in 1210 and mentioned a large tree next to it. Moses Basola wrote about it in his travel writings of the 1520s. He stated, "We came to Amuka, a place that certainly fits its name. First you climb a very high mountain, and then you descend to a valley, where there is a village of about 60 households. Near the village is the grave of Jonathan ben Uziel. It has a stone marker built on it, and a mulberry tree, renowned for its beauty and for the thickness of its branches, the likes of which cannot be found anywhere else." Many miracle stories have been told about people who found their soulmate at Amuka. One popular story is that of a young woman who accidentally left her prayer book at the site. A young man who also visited found the book with her name written in it and tracked her down to return the book. They ended up falling in love and getting married. I have read several other first-person stories of people finding their soulmates after a visit to Amuka. Last week, on the yard site of Yonatan ben Uziel, several thousand people visited the tomb, and local authorities had to arrange for traffic and parking. The tree, as described by the writers of the Middle Ages, no longer exists. Legend has it that a wealthy non-Jewish man wished to build a large house and chopped down the tree for construction material, but his house tragically collapsed. The survivors brought back all the pieces of the tree and returned them in front of the gravesite. Today, there is a tree near the tomb, which visitors have decorated with scarves. Some women believe this act symbolizes their prayers to find their soulmate. However, others discourage the practice. One single woman I know told me she had been to Amuka multiple times and visited the large stone complex topped by a blue dome, which covers the tomb. She described the tradition of circling the structure 7 times, similar to the tradition at a wedding. But to this day, she is still not married. "Don't bother going, Ben," she told me. "It's a long ride to a remote location. You can always go another time." After much debate, I contacted my travel buddies and canceled my space in the car. The next day, I was told that the group never made it to Amuka after all. This podcast will have to serve in place of an actual visit. This has been a moment in Jewish history. Thank you to Yishai Fleischer. Thank you to my friends that offered to drive me to Amuka. Thank you to all the listeners, and shalom.
All right, fabulous. Ben Bresky, thank you so much for filling us with great knowledge and great thoughts. And that's so important, Malka, to have a healthy diet of knowledge and thoughts. Mm-hmm. That's why it's so important to learn Torah.
It's also delicious.
It's also, what's delicious? Oh, that's right. That's what you're saying? Okay, we'll get to that in a second. I get that. but it is really, it's really important. Yes. That's why you have to align yourself with the good things in this world. Like, for example, today's Gimel Tammuz. I mean, if we're going to talk about Gimel Tammuz, which is the Lubavitcher Rebbe's yard site, I highly recommend Chabad.org for so much information, and certainly their like Torah learning online that they have. They're including bar mitzvah learning. They have a fabulous app there. So just, you know, go to Chabad.org. That's a great website. Sepharia or Sepharia, however you pronounce it. They have all the basically digitized Jewish knowledge.
Incredible, so many, incredible website.
So many great folks doing such great things out there to teach. I was in Hebron and I saw Rebbetzin Shani Tarragon with a group from Matan, which is a Jewish a yeshiva, but they were Bible teachers walking around Hebron being taught by a master Bible teacher, and they're going back to their communities to teach Bible. I was like, yes, that's so good. That's the way to do it. We've got to spread more Bible, spread that love, spread that knowledge. Another way to do it is to read the right websites in terms of news, and I really recommend two. I recommend JewishPress.com and JNS.org. What's interesting is that these two are kind of a little bit different in their approach, and yet if you read both of them, you're going to get a great sense. JNS.org is kind of a little bit more, hard information and very serious op-eds from like the leading thinkers in our time. And JewishPress.com is more feisty, more scrappy, and more like on the scene immediately fast. These two websites will really complement your understanding of what's going on. So JNS.org and JewishPress.com. I don't have to tell you that consuming bad media is just bad for you, and consuming good media is really good for you. So check out those two sponsors to the show. Malka, what else do we have? Do we have something else that we want to talk about?
We were just going to say hi to our friends at Prohibition Pickle.
That's right. That's exactly it, Prohibition Pickle. Actually, they just catered the Shlomo and Miriam wedding.
Yes, it was very tasty tasteful.
Yes, that tasty and tasteful. Oh my God, did you just came up with that? That is so good, Malka.
TM.
That's right, tasty and tasteful. There you go, TM Malka. Trademark Malka, TM. Actually, Malka, there is one more thing that I do want to talk about. I get very frustrated in these times when the diaspora and Israel are at different times.
I think you even mentioned this last week. That is how upset you are.
It just stinks. And because for a guy like me who's trying to do a radio show out of the land of Israel and talk about the Torah portion, it's tricky because everybody in the diaspora is behind us. Now, when we start the Abrahamic communities, I was thinking about this. I think we will concentrate on the Torah portion that is in the land of Israel. Since non-Jews won't have like a second day thing, because they don't have to keep something, that's what I'm thinking. That I think that they have to just, I think we just have to simply orient the Abrahamic faith around what's happening in Israel. Just
we'll
that simple.
See.
That's how I think.
It's a lot of considerations.
There you go. There are thoughts being thought here. Deep thoughts are being thought. Malka, here in the diaspora, the Torah portion is Korach, and we heard a little bit about that from Rabbi Shimshon Edel. Here in the land of Israel, it's Chukat. It's a favorite of mine. It's got a lot of amazing stories. It's got the passing of Aaron and Miriam. Aaron and Miriam pass away, and basically Moses pass away. He doesn't pass away, but he's told that he's not going into the promised land.
That hurts.
And this is because he takes, God tells him, take the staff and talk to the rock.
Yeah.
And the tricky thing is that a little bit imperceptibly, but we know it without a shadow of a doubt, that Moses now in this Torah portion is at the end of the 40 years of the sojourn in the desert, the long march in the desert. And so this generation that he's talking to is a new generation. And God said to him, take the stick. Last time you had to hit the rock. This time, no, hitting the rock connotes force. This time, take the stick, show that there's force, but talk to the rock. Show that first there is
diplomacy
and kindness, and it doesn't have to come in strength. I need you to show that face. And Moses here shows something a little bit uncharacteristic. We know that Moses, at the end of his life, is still full of vigor and strength, and God basically takes him out of this world. But at this moment, he shows a little bit of, let's call it, a touch of humanity, in the sense that he relates to this generation as being like the last generation. Like, are you still being recalcitrant and stubborn, and you're not following the ways of the Lord? So he smashes the rock. He didn't understand that it was time to transition. It was time to shift a gear. Like, yeah, they're doing the same thing like their parents, but doesn't matter. This is a new generation. We got to teach them with a new way. And basically, God was saying, with all due respect, you are the man for all generations, Moses. You're the great teacher. And every word of Torah is infused with the spirit of Moses. But it's a new generation. And you have to now, you belong to the previous generation.
Mm.
And I saw also in the Midrash, a very simple Midrash. I like sometimes these simple phrases. It says, what, you're going to go in, but your whole generation is going to be dead? Like, the generation that you led is all dead, but you're going to go in? That's not right.
Oh.
That's not right.
Well, but Yehoshua and Kalev went in?
Okay, because they had the merit, and they needed, the next generation still needed that spirit. But at the end, Yehoshua and Kalev are actually they're the inheritors. They're actually related to the next generation. Joshua, for sure, is not Moses. He's the next after Moses.
Right.
So they inherit, but the point is that we learn here a very important thing, which is you got to live with the times. You got to live with the times. I remember years ago, I saw my mom. The internet was just starting up, and she's like, and she was downstairs in our basement in America when we were living there, and she was like learning the internet. I'm like, Mom, what are you doing? She's like, I can't fall behind. I got to be with the times. I got to make sure that I know I'm up on the technology of today. It's a very simple phrase, she said, but I was just like, wow, she's like taking the time to be up on the technology of today. Like Moses here shows that he's related to a previous generation. He's taking the anger that he has from his relationship to a previous generation, bring it to this new one that doesn't fit anymore. And so therefore you don't belong to this next generation. You're not quite ready for them. That being said, he then goes to war with the kings of the land of Israel that need to be conquered, and he destroys them, he beats them, and Og Melech HaBashan, and Sichon, he defeats them, and he is very proud of that at the end of his life. I just mean to say that his vigor is still very much.
Yeah, he doesn't fizzle out.
That's another thing, which is okay. You got some bad news, you know.
Right, you don't get to retire.
You don't retire. You're just like, okay, you know what I mean, setback, fine, but I'm still here, and I'm still ready to go. And Aaron leaves the scene, and Miriam leaves the scene, and Aaron leaves the scene in such a beautiful way. He basically removes his clothes, hands them to his son, Eleazar. We have a son named Eleazar. And lays down, and God basically gives him the kiss of passing away and takes his soul. And even Moses is jealous of how Aaron gets to go, and he asks for that same way. The point is
and then
that
the nation mourns for 30 days.
The nation's like,
they're devastated. Aaron was like their mommy.
It was their daddy and mommy, but it was definitely
like he was like no, but he was like sweet to them.
He was the peacemaker. He was the peacemaker. That's actually that you say that now, that actually clarifies another thing, and I'm going to have to add what you just said now into my way longer thought about the relationship of Moses and Aaron, in that is really there's the sweetness side to Aaron and a law and truth, like truth capital T, side to Moses, and they are best when they are together, and synthesize that their two characteristic traits. But the minute that Aaron's gone, then Moses hits the rock a little too hard. You know what I'm saying? It's a little too, the truth is,
yeah, you didn't get that brotherly shoulder rub in the morning, and then the rest is history.
Or the people weren't able to receive it in that way that they needed to receive it. In any case, that is the greatness of our Torah, that it shows us strengths and weaknesses, and it is just eminently true. It's so deeply, deeply true, and the lessons of the Torah are still with us today. All right, folks, one more organization that I want to promote is highonthehar.com. If you want to go to the Temple Mount, you can go through High on the Har and reach out to me in general about Temple Mount or about any tours and things that you want to see here in the land of Israel. Always available by email, yishai@yishaifleisher.com. High on the Har is highonthehar.com. Write me an email, yishai@yishaifleisher.com. Thanks to the supporters of Buy Me a Coffee. We really appreciate it. It's really
very much.
It makes a huge difference in our sense of ability to be the shlichim, to be emissaries through this format, through the time that we take out. And so that's called buymeacoffee.com/yishai. And if you want to be involved right now in some of the bigger projects that we're doing, including the Biblical Highway, including the Tomb of Ruth and Yishai and Chevron and other projects, go to yishaifleisher.com. And there's a donate button there. It makes a big difference. In any case, my friends, I want to really thank you and bless you. Thank you to all the folks that make the show happen, including Rabbi Shimshon Nadel and Ben Bresky, Yocheved, Tabitha, Lou, Moshe Herman, getting it out to the world. Lou, when we're live. Did I forget anybody? And, of course, you, Malka Fleischer.
Yes.
And we thank, of course, Hashem, for giving us the strength to broadcast his word. Now is a time for prayers, everybody. We got to pray right now for the strength of Israel. We got to get through this period. It's going to be a bumpy period, but we're going to get through it because we have destiny, providential destiny to fulfill. Hashem's great vision is not going to be stopped by anybody. There are forces that want to delay us. We won't let them. Let's continue the great work of previous generations, including the Lubavitcher Rebbe, which we celebrate today. here in Gimel Tammuz, and may God continue to give us strength to be emissaries for His great vision in this world. God bless you folks wherever you are. Shabbat shalom. Lots of love from the land of blessings. And shalom.
Shalom.